Welcome to Upthinking Finance, a podcast that offers a unique and discerning view of economics and financial planning. Here is your host, Emerson Fersh.
Welcome back to another edition of Upthinking Finance. I'm Emerson Fersh.
Researcher and freedom activist Mark Passio once said, there are only two mistakes you can make on the path to truth. One is not starting, the other is not going all the way. This is episode 50 of Upthinking Finance. I want to thank everybody who's been with me from the beginning and also welcome those of you who just joined recently. While economics and finance is certainly an underlying theme and sometimes the primary part of the discussion, the reality of it is the role of money and the decisions that come with it impact literally every aspect of our lives. And so that's really the goal of these interviews I have, is really just to bring interesting people on where we can have an honest discussion about what's going on and their experiences in life. One area that I've had a hard time getting exposure to or getting a discussion in is the entertainment industry, mainly because there aren't a lot of people I really have any personal interest in talking to. And another is that it's hard to find people that are willing to really be honest about what they see and what's going on. However, today's guest comes to us from a music background. His name is Mark Devlin. He's a UK-based club and radio DJ, music journalist, and author. As a DJ, he's played gigs in over 40 different countries. In 2010, he underwent what he refers to as a conscious awakening, bringing a new awareness of what's really going on in this world. His special area of interest was how this ties into the mainstream music industry and the way in which A-list artists have been used to manipulate and mind control the masses in line with a much larger agenda. He now presents public talks on these subjects, as well as appearing on radio and producing two regular podcast series. So you can see this guy's busy. And of course, that's the reason why I'm here in the office at 4 a.m. to do this interview, because that was the only time he had available. In early 2016, he published his comprehensive book, Musical Truth. And just to digress on that, I've been dissecting that volume. I will tell you this, it's a big dose. The thing that's great about him, just like the last interview I had with the author of One Idea to Rule Them All, is that there's a lot of research done and he's got receipts for everything he shares. There's the citations. He's just obviously done the work. So really interesting reading. Volume 2 of Musical Truth appeared in early 2018, with Volume 3 that coming out in late 2021. His allegorical novel, The Cause and the Cure, appeared in 2019 with its sequel, The Gift and the Curse, in late 2023. So it's my pleasure to welcome today, coming to us from the UK, Mark Devlin, who's located in the UK. Mark, thank you for joining me this morning.
Hello, mate. No worries. Happy to be here.
Thank you. So obviously, I shared before when we first talked, I came acquainted with you at your discussion at the Better Way Conference in Bath last summer. And I wanted to ask you if maybe you could just start. You talked about a stealth war, and this is a theme that's come up with a few of the guests I've had on, John Waters in Ireland. I had Michelle Stiles on last week, who wrote a book called One Idea to Rule Them All, and it's about propaganda. And so it's common. There's a lot of people who are seeing things, and maybe you could just share a little bit about that before we dive into your experiences in the entertainment industry.
Sure. Well, if you've got a control system that openly declares war on the people, so tanks rolling down the street, soldiers with jackboots breaking down doors, the populace knows in no uncertain terms that it's at war, that its government or controllers have declared war on it. But a far more effective way for them to enslave entire populations is to enslave them through the mind and to coerce them into certain behaviors, certain actions, certain ways of thinking. And that's what's being done now. I think they've worked out this is a far more effective way of achieving their goals. So they do it through the weaponization of psychology. They do it through the hijacking of popular culture and entertainment, music, movies, TV shows, which is my specialty area. They do it through the mainstream media and all the propaganda and the lies that they spin. And they do it through government ministers and, again, all the lies and deceptions that they push. So most people don't realize that they are at war with those who they think of as beneficent. So most people trust their government. Imagine that. Incredible. Most people trust the evening news. They think that when they switch it on, they're getting the truth of what's happening in the world. They've got no idea that they're having their thought systems and their values and their ideas shaped and molded for them through the very clever use of psychology. So the enemies that we have these days aren't generals and admirals and lieutenant colonels. They're behavioral scientists and psychologists who know exactly how the human mind operates and how to manipulate it. And I would argue that they're a far more dangerous opponent than the overt ones, because you have millions of people walking around thinking everything's fine in the world. They have no idea.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine nowadays. I mean, it's hard to really believe that people aren't really seeing. I mean, it's like it's so in your face. Nobody's hiding anything anymore. So you've been in the music industry for a number of years now. Maybe just explain the awakening you had with that, if you can, because it sounded pretty dramatic to me. I'm one of these guys who didn't really start to see things until the COVID began, but you're obviously been aware for a lot longer of a time, and maybe just share that if you could.
Sure. I like COVID new recruits, those that have woken up to truth since 2020, because they have that fire burning within them still. And there's that passion that really drives them on and galvanizes them. And that's the way it was for me back in the day when I first came to truth. But yeah, I love meeting people that kind of woke up to all the nonsense of the past 4 years, because they still have that fire burning within them, right? Whereas with guys like me, we're a bit cynical, we're a bit jaded, we're a bit battle weary by now. So I'm going back the best part of 15 years, or maybe just over 15 years, to when I first started paying attention to the dynamics that are really operating in this world. So I was a radio and club DJ. I got going in 1990, started out doing radio stuff, local radio station in Oxford, England. And then I got a really good radio gig in Bristol on a station called Galaxy Radio. Mm. And that kind of kickstarted my club DJing career as well. So I was getting gigs in clubs. I was playing up and down the UK. I was fortunate enough to play internationally as well. I went to about 40 odd different countries, came to the United States a few times, and life was great. I was enjoying it. And the only thing that really mattered to me was parties, gigs, music, tunes. But things got to a stage around about 2007, 2008, where I really started questioning the nature of this world itself, this reality, because I was looking around me and I was seeing a whole load of stuff that didn't make sense. I couldn't comprehend why there were always wars. There was always strife and conflict and famine and poverty. And I wondered why that was. Did a bit of delving, did a bit of reading of various authors, and I came to realize that all that stuff is in place because it's set up to be that way. It's not accident, it's not random chance that we always have this sort of turmoil in the world. We have a control system, which many call the elites, and they conspire to make these things happen. And it's been this way pretty much throughout the field of recorded human history. So I got into the books of David Icke, and they really gave me a kick up the ass. Prior to that, I was of the view, along with most British people, that the poor man had lost his mind and he was a nutter. But I was encouraged by my dad, actually, to take a look at his books. And I did with an open mind. And I found they made a lot of sense. And they actually answered a lot of the questions I'd had up to that point. Then I got on to some other authors and researchers. I found the work of Mark Passio, which I found incredibly ass-kicking. It's like he's smacking you about the face with a baseball bat and saying, you have to do something. There's problems in this world and you've got to take personal responsibility for it. So he was a pretty major galvanizing force as well. And I realized that there was kind of a gap in the market, a bit of a niche for somebody to comment on how the music industry played its part in what was going on in the world. So you had experts that were talking about the banking and financial system and the big scam that is, geopolitical conspiracies, things of that nature, the world of science, the world of academia, how the mainstream media manipulates people. But there wasn't really anyone talking about the music industry and how music has been weaponized. And so being a music man and having a large record collection and knowing a thing or two about music, not just the genres I was playing in the clubs, which was black music. It was mainly R&B, hip hop, rap, reggae, that sort of stuff. I knew a fair bit about rock music and these other forms of popular music as well. So I thought, well, I guess that's my job then. So I set myself on the path of researching all that stuff. The result was my first musical truth book, which I self-published in early 2016. Then I did volume 2 in 2018, volume 3 in 2021, started doing talks on the sort of lecture conference circuit. I've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of podcast interviews like this. It's a lot of work, man, over the last 15 years. So I've just been constantly banging on about how music has been weaponized and how popular culture is used for social engineering and getting right inside the mindset of the general population.
So you were living the life, right? You were enjoying it, you know, the excitement. Because, I mean, you know how people, I don't know what it's like in Europe. I imagine it's the same. People here, you know, they want to be athletes. Everybody wants to be famous. That's the thing. You know, athletes, rock stars, all that. But your book, and I've dug into most of this first volume already, it's a big dose. And the cool part is you have all the receipts. I mean, you've got the research. But I mean, is disillusioned a word, or is that just not enough to describe kind of once you started to connect the dots within the industry itself?
Well, jaded would be one word. Numb would be another. Just left feeling numb, not comfortably numb, but just numb. It was a real pisser to discover these things, particularly about artists that I had admired up to that point. So I was a guy that was into rap and hip hop. And then I discovered the true nature of people like Jay-Z and Dr. Dre and what they're involved with, and Puff Daddy, P. Diddy, you know, his whole world is unraveling right now about bloody time because he's been manipulating and screwing artists over for the past 30 years. But yeah, it's a bitter pill to swallow. Electronic dance music, that's another one. I came up in the sort of acid house rave era of the late 80s, and that all meant a lot to me. But in recent times, I've come to discover that many aspects of that scene constitute social engineering psyops, ways to change societal attitudes among young people in line with further reaching agendas. So yeah, it's difficult. And often when I do public talks at the end of it, there's a lot of disappointed looking faces and people are like, oh no, does that mean I've got to throw out my Rolling Stones album collection or throw out all my Doors records? And what I say to people is, no, you don't have to do that. You can still enjoy the music for the music's sake, because the music from these kinds of bands is the very best out there. I'm not saying they're the most talented bands, but they're the ones that were obviously picked and groomed for success. And therefore, they got access to the best recording studios, the best recording equipment, the best producers and engineers, meaning that their output is the very best that you can get. So it's quality music. Many of these songs are great. Many of them actually have empowering lyrics that really speak to the human condition for various reasons. So you can still enjoy the music. What I try to do is make people consciously aware of who the artists really were and the circumstances in which these records were produced. So you don't have to throw them all out. It's a personal free will choice. Some people choose to have nothing to do with these artists anymore, and I can respect that decision. But personally, I can't imagine living in a world without music. And often people say to me, well, if we can't listen to these established bands anymore, because we know that they were pushing agendas and they're not to be trusted, what music can we listen to? And I always point them towards the huge amount of really great truth and freedom music, which is being produced. You have to look really hard to find it because you'll never hear it on the radio. But there's a whole load of bands, musicians, singer-songwriters, rappers, producers who are putting out amazing music that really speaks to these times. They're self-producing it. They're self-publishing it. They're not relying on major record labels. They're just doing everything independently. And it's really high caliber, really high quality. I do a conscious music podcast called The Sound of Freedom, where I curate a whole load of this stuff. And I'm up to, I think it's 116 episodes now. So if anyone does want to listen to some empowering truth and freedom music, that's where they can find it. But in terms of the mainstream stuff, it's a personal choice. You know, you can chuck it out or you can become consciously aware. And when you do, you kind of break those mind control spells, because that's what they're doing with these mainstream artists. They're helping to push various so-called globalist agendas. They're pushing occult symbolism. They're pushing aspects of Satanism, unfortunately, in many cases. There's other kinds of unsavory stuff going on as well. But once you're aware that this stuff is there, and particularly when you can spot signs and symbols that they use, because one of the tenets of the dark occultists that run these industries, because that's what they are at their core level, is that they like to put their little calling cards everywhere. So they pepper their videos and their record sleeves and their promotional photographs with signs and symbols, which kind of indicate what they're all about. But when you learn to spot the signs and symbols and you become symbol literate, these things come out of the subconscious mind, which is where they work their magic and have their effect, into the conscious mind, where they can be recognized and processed. And like I say, the spell is broken and they no longer have that effect. So a big part of my work has been getting people to remove all this stuff from their subconscious mind, where it's been absorbed like a sponge pretty much all their lives, and get it into the conscious mind and recognize what's really going on here.
You mentioned earlier, and you talked about when you kind of started to see things, and this maybe was in your book too, about people starving and just the inequalities of things. And what's interesting about it when I read that, and again, when you said it, is we just kind of accept this stuff. This is like, I was born in California, you know, well, if I had to pick a state growing up, I mean, where else would you want to live, right? On the beach, that whole glitzy lifestyle, the Showtime Lakers in the 80s. I mean, that was just cool. I just thought I was one of the lucky ones. But the whole thing is there's another step to actually questioning this stuff. Looking at, why do people have to starve? Why is there so much suffering? Why are people wandering like zombies in downtown Philadelphia and San Francisco and all these places? I mean, why? And that's the thing that's kind of the next step to all this. But to your last point, it's when you talk about the entertainment industry, because you've got this, I remember seeing somewhere this Lady Gaga thing where she's like in some kind of devilish scene. Then you had, what was it, the Grammys or something, where the hosts, they're all dressed up like with devil outfits. And people, you just accept it. Okay, well, this is this weird entertainment industry with their just trying to get attention. And it's easy to write this stuff off. But what you're exposing in the book, and again, with tons of references and material, is no, there's actually, it's intentional, right? I mean, there's a purpose to it. It's not just trying to be cool and different and whatever. There's literally an objective.
Yeah. What's incredible to me is that you'll often have conversations with regular people, we might call them normies, and it will get onto politics. And they might discuss some MP, some politician that's been involved in some dodgy, shady business deal, and it's got into the papers. And they'll say something like, well, you know, all politicians are corrupt, it's just what they're like. And then you might hear of some Catholic priest that's been accused of sexually abusing some choir boy. And people will say, well, you know, it's just what these Catholic priests are like. The question becomes, why are we accepting this? How is this acceptable? And look at what was done to everyone during the COVID era. If you'd asked even me, with all the research I've done, and as you say, there's a whole ton of resources in my book, because I show where I've taken the information from, so people know I'm not just pulling it out of the ether. If you'd said to me in late 2019 that people are going to be behaving in the way that they did in 2020 and 2021, wearing masks, queuing up outside stores, shutting down their businesses, jumping into the road to get away from people as they walk past them, thinking that they're going to kill them when they breathe on them, I would never have believed it. Even with everything that I'd researched, I would never have believed that the psychos in control would have got away with it. But they did. And it goes further than that. You've got the agenda which followed COVID. I don't know how censored we are here, but I'm talking about, you know, the arms spears. And again, nobody would ever have believed that they would have got away with the huge body count and number of people that have been physically maimed for life without the whistle being blown on it. Here we are, a couple of years down the line, and I would have thought that by now, the whole thing would have been blown wide open and everybody would be able to accept what's been going on. But they don't. They're still getting away with it. They're literally getting away with murder. And that really bothers me every day, because I know what methods have been used to achieve it. It's mind control. It's hypnosis, actually. There's a guy called Matthias Desmet who talks about mass formation psychosis. And he did an interview with Mickey Willis, filmmaker, went into this. And he's talking about how methods of deep hypnosis have been used on the general public to get them to behave in certain ways and to believe certain things. Nothing else would have done it. And it's military grade, meaning it's the best weaponry that the control system has. Again, it's not tanks and machine guns anymore. It's getting inside people's minds. And it's just incredible to me, because I never would have believed that they would have been able to pull it off. A lot of my friends who are into the same sort of research as me say they sort of tip their hat to these psychos because they've pulled off an incredible stunt and they never would have believed that they'd done it. And they've got a sort of grudging admiration towards them. I don't feel that way. I feel nothing but utter contempt towards these people. And I feel like I'm at war with them. I'm never going to tip my hat to them. I think is outrageous what they've done, but it's also incredible that they have been able to pull it off. So yeah, who would have believed that the world would be this way? And I think it stands as proof that it's all systematic. None of it is random. None of it happens just chance. We're at a psychological war here.
You made a comment at the Better Way conference about how people, and you kind of alluded to in the beginning, they don't expect to be attacked from the war vernacular while they're listening to music or watching TV at night. And so I was going to say, maybe if you could, in your book, you said it kind of started with the King of Rock and Roll. Is there a way to just summarize kind of what's happened over the decades, how it's changed? Is that a possible thing just to kind of show how the music get into that aspect of how it's actually gone? Because you talked about, if I remember, the role of family. I mean, it gets into morals, basic things people have accepted. And it's been a kind of sounds like an insidious, slow process to shift that. Is that a fair question?
Yeah. So I'll attempt to give you a potted history of the past 70 years in about 5 minutes.
Perfect.
So my research pretty much starts in the mid-1950s. So prior to that, in Britain and America and most of the rest of the world, you had the post-war era. So things were very austere. Money was still very scarce. People's lifestyles were very non-glamorous. Music was kind of piano music and sheet music and chamber music and classical music. There was no popular music to speak of, but there was a strong family value. There was a lot of emphasis put on the traditional family unit. So that's the way society was structured. So then the mid-50s come along, and first of all, you have Bill Haley and his Comets, and they came out with Rock Around the Clock and Shake, Rattle and Roll and these songs. And they were like the first rock and roll records. And they were ushering in the first sex and drugs and rock and roll era. The following year, 1956, you had the career of Elvis Presley launched. Elvis had a lot of links to the intelligence services. And this is something you find with so many of these popular artists. I've got a talk which I take out on the circuit called Music's Military and Mind Control Connections, where I break down a lot of this stuff. So Elvis's act on stage was very sexually suggestive and kind of lewd for the time. And teenage girls loved it because it was awakening this sort of dormant sexuality within them that had been suppressed up to that time. And he was a sensation. And then you had other rock and roll acts, you know, Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and Buddy Holly and people like this. And that kind of paved the way for what was to come in the 60s. So you had what was referred to as the British invasion in America, which is all these British bands like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Who, the Kinks, the Animals that were all coming over from England. And the crazy thing about that is they were taking effectively American rhythm and blues music that had been perfected on those shores, repackaging them and then selling them back to the Americans. And Americans lapped it up. They thought, oh, this is great. These British bands have incredible music, not realizing that they'd taken it from America. But, you know, they were really big by design. Obviously, the Beatles were the biggest band of them all. And then you had their supposed rivals, the Rolling Stones, although they would appear to have both been controlled by the same forces. And most of these groups had connections to the intelligence services, to the Tavistock Institute, which is a social engineering think tank in London, where a lot of these social engineering psyops are dreamt up. And so the 60s sort of drifted into the latter part of that decade. And that was when the so-called counterculture began, the sort of hippie flower power scene. That's where drugs arrived on the scene big time, not least LSD. And all of the LSD that was going into these music festivals and these hippie gatherings and such can be shown to have come from the CIA. The CIA are the biggest drug pushers on earth. And that was all about changing society. It was all about breaking up the traditional family unit. It was about sexualizing young people. So the arrival of the birth control pill came at the same time. You had the feminist movement spearheaded by Gloria Steinem, which was encouraging women to get out of the home into the workplace and put their children into state-sponsored education and care at ever earlier ages, where the indoctrination could begin. And it was about free love and specifically about the young people of the time stopping being political activists of any sort. So in the mid to late 1960s, the Vietnam War was raging, and there was a lot of opposition to it in principle by young people and particularly students on college campuses. In steps Dr. Timothy Leary, another CIA asset, and he encourages the young people of the time, in the mantra of the time, to turn on, tune in, drop out, meaning drop out of society, drop out of any participation in political activism, and particularly opposition to the Vietnam War, and just take drugs, man, you know, do LSD, do mushrooms, smoke weed, have free love, free sex with whoever you want, just chill out, hang out, and don't get involved in anything. And that was a way of just completely destroying any anti-war sentiment that there was among that youthful generation. It's an absolute masterclass in how social engineering gets done. And then they sort of put the nails in the coffin of the 1960s. There were a few events which really just finished off all those hippie peace and love ideals, not least the so-called Tate Manson murders in August of 69 and the Rolling Stones Altamont concert in December of 69. Where four people died. So then in comes the 70s. You've got different forms of music, mainly these big rock bands. So the likes of Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and Queen. And then later you've got the punk and new wave movement. And then all the styles that followed in the wake of that. And so it was like agenda after agenda after agenda achieved through different music genres. Over here in the UK, we had a big acid house rave scene in the late 80s, which led to electronic dance music and club culture in the 90s. And in my view, in my estimation, with evidence to back it up, it was all agendas. It was all changing societal attitudes in some way through music. And this is the genius thing about it, because when you think you're just enjoying some leisure time, listening to a favorite band, listening to a favorite album, going to a gig, watching a movie, watching a TV show, unwinding after a hard day at work, you think that you're just getting mindless fun, entertainment, imagination, and fantasy. You don't imagine for a minute that you're actually being mind controlled and that you're having your entire value system and your view of what's going on in the world and your place in it shaped and molded for you by what you're watching or listening to. It's a genius way of doing it because people's guards are down. They just have no idea this stuff is going on. And so it all gets soaked up by the subconscious mind, as I said earlier, which is where all the magic works. And you have a lot of people wandering around with all these ideas in their head, and they don't even realize that they're there, but they're affecting the way they think and the way they behave. And that'll be one of the ways that they pulled this COVID stunt off. Because for years and decades leading up to it, in movies and TV shows, you had narratives involving the outbreak of a deadly airborne pathogen that was spread by people breathing on each other. In most of the narratives, it came out of China. And the only way to deal with it in all these films, all these TV shows, was harsh lockdowns, shutting down businesses, staying at home, social distancing. They even refer to it as that, the wearing of masks, and of course, ultimately, the administration of these. So that is one of the ways through which they got people to behave in these ways. I know it was done through those methods.
So I guess the obvious question is, and you may have already answered it, you know, where's the creative, the genuine creative spirit? Because I know the book, I mean, you get into a lot of specifics, people, you know, the Kanye West, and how many of these people have quoted, they've sold their soul to the devil. I think Bob Dylan was one I've heard. And then you mentioned Katy Perry. So there's this theme. But, and maybe it's like the Tom McDonalds of today that are these independent rappers, because the trade-off here is there's sort of a sadness when you hear this, because it's like, well, where's the creative energy, the uniqueness? Is it genuine or is it just manufactured? You know what I'm asking? I'm not sure I'm communicating it right, but I know what I'm thinking.
Right. Yeah. You're asking who's genuine and who's sincere and who's making music from the heart, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that goes back to my earlier comment about these truth and freedom artists who you've got to hunt really hard for, but they are out there. And I meet a lot of these guys at festivals and such. You know, I'm often on the same bill as them and they're performing. And you could just tell that they're doing it from the heart. So we all bring different gifts to the table. You're doing your show there, which is great. I do what I do. These musicians do what they do. They put truth into songs. And you can communicate as much empowering truth in a really great 3 or 4 minute song as you can in a 500 page book or a 5 hour lecture if it's done right. So we all bring whatever gifts we can. And that creative spirit is still out there. The controllers seek to stifle it. And I think in many cases, if we're not talking about long running bloodline families, because a lot of celebrities, a lot of musicians are selected from important bloodline families, which are ushered into positions of influence and power in society. So you often find from the same family, certain members will go into politics, other members will become musicians, others will get into big business. I mean, just for an example, just plucked out of so many, Mick Jones of The Clash, who was also in Big Audio Dynamite, his cousin is Grant Shapps, who is the former transport secretary in Boris Johnson's cabinet in British politics. And also in The Clash, you had Joe Strummer, real name John Graham Mellor. His father, Ronald Mellor, was a British diplomat working for the Foreign Service, in other words, the government. So in a band which is perceived as working class and representing the people and rebellious, you've got two members with direct family links to prominent politicians. And that dynamic is by no means limited just to The Clash. We find it absolutely everywhere in popular music. So if you're not from one of these bloodline families, I feel that many of these bands are selected on the basis of their talent. So to start with, they are genuinely talented. They're writing great songs, putting on some great performances. And this gets noticed because the industry has spotters whose job it is to pick out who they think could be the next big thing, who could be coerced into selling their soul, so to speak, and starting to push agendas. And that's how many of them get into it. I think they're made a very attractive offer. Some A&R guy will come up to them at the end of a gig and say, "That was awesome. I work for such and such a label. Come in for a meeting." And they do, and they get made this incredible offer, all this money, all this wealth, album deals, and video production and all this. And for many of them, it seems so attractive that they just sign on that dotted line. But unfortunately, the minute they do, that's when they wave goodbye to their souls, because from that point on, they're doing what they're told. And many of them won't realize it until it's too late, because there comes a point where you can't get out. And so that's why we do find a lot of really good creative talent in many of these controlled bands. And also, we find a lot of songs which are very meaningful, very empowering. They talk about the things us truthers do. And you can listen to an album track from maybe Genesis or Queen or some band, that Black Sabbath even. Black Sabbath, when they weren't pushing satanic imagery, actually had some really great lyrics in their songs, empowering lyrics. And I think when we get those, it's coming from the heart and the soul of the artist. And it's them being allowed to express themselves in the odd song, just here and there, buried away on an album. It's not what they're mainly known for, but with most groups, you find that kind of song somewhere in their canon of work. And I think that's the creative spirit of the songwriters, which is yearning to express itself freely, but it can't because it's stifled, it's controlled, and the rest of the time, it's doing what it's told by its bosses and it's pushing agendas on instruction.
And I know we're just about winding out of time here. When you think about this stuff, like I'm a big, Van Halen's another band I've loved forever. David Lee Roth. I'm not a Sammy Hagar guy. Got to deal
with the guy.
Yeah. But, you know, you think about these guys and again, growing up in California, they started in Pasadena. I think they're playing up in those band, you know, those clubs, the Whiskey A Go-Go and the Troubadour. And when you think about that, and it's like this cool story, it's like, yeah, these guys started and they're LA band. And then I guess the sadness of a lot of what we're dealing with now, and it's in all aspects of life, is the reality that when you start connecting the dots, you, as you shared, and you see these, this a very patient group of people that have been implementing, getting this, it's like playing the long game, you know? And so when you start to realize that it's like, this is just another part of this system and how has it impacted my life? I mean, it's pretty disturbing. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I had this conversation, I don't know if you know John Waters in Ireland, but we talk a lot about just the impact on our life and what's real, what isn't. And
he was the father of one of Sinead O'Connor's children.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. We never talked about that, but Alex Craner had mentioned that to me and he spoke at your conference last year too. But So I guess just a final thought, because I know you've got a lot of things to take care of. You mentioned in the book about the price of fame, and I guess you've already kind of talked about it, but maybe just people always aspire. You know, we were living in a neighborhood in Orange County before we moved out here to Utah. And it seemed like every kid, you know, you ask them what they want to do. I want to be a professional athlete. You know, not realizing that there's, you know, these trade-offs. Maybe just explain a little bit about that part of it as before we end, close out our interview here.
When I first came across this dynamic, I was concerned that I might not have got it right because it seemed so outrageous and so fantastic to me that in those early days when I was putting together Musical Truth 1, I was writing that book in 2014 and 2015. And there were various points where I thought, God, I hope I've got this right. I mean, I'm going out on a limb here with some of this stuff that I'm saying. And I'm burning bridges because as soon as I put out this book with all these wild claims in it, many people are not going to want to associate with me anymore. I'm not going to get DJ gigs and people are just going to think I've lost my mind. But every time I had that doubt and I was like, God, have I got this right? Can this be correct? Something came along to validate it. And I realized that all these things that I'd stumbled across were absolutely true. Something would always back it up. Somebody would email me synchronistically and say, I used to work in a record company. I've seen all this stuff happen. You're absolutely on the money. What you're saying is absolutely right. So I've had constant validation right from the start. And so I do stand by everything that I've asserted in those books, and nothing has come along to make me change my viewpoint on them. So the price of fame, like I say, there are many artists who are born into these bloodline families where they don't really have any choice. They're told from the earliest age, you're going to be a successful rock star. You're going to be a famous movie actor. And that path is laid out for them, generation after generation. Then there are these acts and these bands, as I said, who are selected and groomed to be of use, to be of service to the big record labels, corporations, because they've recognized the talent within them. But this concept, which crops up a lot in the music industry, of the Faustian bargain. So this goes back to the German legend of Faust, who was an individual who had great privilege in life and he'd done many incredible things in his life, but he still thirsted knowledge about what it's all about and just greater occult knowledge. And in the story, he makes a deal with the devil, Satan, Lucifer, whatever name you want to put on it, where he gives up his mortal soul in exchange for this great worldly knowledge. And he makes the deal and then, of course, regrets it. And in the music industry, we have various retellings of the Faustian bargain, which crop up. One involves Robert Johnson, the blues musician, who is said to have made a deal with the devil at the crossroads out in some remote desert location. The crossroads in this story symbolizes the point where this world, this apparent 3D reality, interacts with the spirit world, and you can cross over between the two. And so this is the site where he's said to have met this entity and traded his soul in exchange for great musical proficiency. And he suddenly, according to people that knew him, became very, very proficient as a jazz guitarist, incredibly talented. Didn't end well for him. He died at the age of 27 in some very bizarre circumstances, becoming an early member of what's known as the 27 Club, which is this large number of musicians who have died at the age of 27 in some bizarre circumstance or other. There was a retelling of that Faustian bargain at the crossroads in a commercial released for BMW in 2002 and starring James Brown. It was directed by Tony Scott, the brother of Ridley Scott, the famous film director, and it depicts a young James Brown in 1954 at 21 years of age, out at some remote desert location at the crossroads, and he's said to be making a deal with the devil. The devil is actually portrayed in this commercial by Gary Oldman, the Hollywood actor, and it basically tells the story of how James Brown became famous because he sold his soul, traded it in exchange for great musical proficiency, or in his case, being a great dancer, great onstage performer. He's said to have been a strong influence on Michael Jackson with many of his dance steps. And it's an incredible thing for a mainstream commercial. This is for BMW, and it's depicting this kind of deal, putting it right into the public mindset. And so we get this story time and time again when it comes to how certain artists became famous. People think it's a metaphor. People think it's allegorical, selling your soul. they don't really mean it. But I would argue that there's a very real sense in which this does happen. I've heard stories of artists having to sign contracts in their own blood to seal a deal. So this is very dark stuff, as you've alluded to. And I think we should probably leave things on a positive note if we could find one, because I don't like to leave people full of doom and gloom. I mean, it's important that people accept this information. And as you've said, my books are full of references and citations to show where I've got this information from. And in many cases, it's comments that the artists themselves have made in interviews. It's come right from the horse's mouth. They've said it. It's not been made up by anyone. You can watch the interviews where they say these things. You mentioned Bob Dylan, that famous interview that he did with Ed Bradley, where he talked about having made a deal with the chief commander in exchange for his long career. But if we're to find a positive note in all this, it's simply that we are now able to comprehend these methods and tactics and these dynamics that have been weaponized against us in a way that previous generations were not. So in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, early noughties, all this stuff was being done to people. They had no idea. These days, we stand a chance of knowing about these things. And when you realize what they're doing and the methods they're using, you stand a chance of breaking that mind control spell and taking back your freedom, your free will, if you choose to. It's always a choice. Most people just continue to operate under societal mind control, but many people have taken that personal responsibility upon themselves to recognize what's going on, face up to it, get it into the conscious mind and deal with it. And the freedom that you win back for yourself and for your soul, both metaphorically and literally, I would say, is incredible. It's invigorating. It's empowering. It's just taking back that energy for yourself instead of feeding it to these vampires that control these industries. So there is some good news in there somewhere, in that we can choose to not participate in these mind control rituals anymore if the will is there to do so.
I'm always up for ending on a rising note of hope. No, and you're right. I think what you just said is there is a freedom in letting go of these shackles, for lack of a better way to put it, and actually seeing and taking the time. You said at the beginning, you know, where we just sort of accept these things and don't question them. You know, it's the world we're presented with. But when you start digging in, and you know, it's cool, Mark, I want to ask you one last question just about your upcoming tour. But 5 years ago, I'll speak for myself, you would have been ready to have this conversation. I wouldn't have. And I can tell you, you know, I run a financial planning firm, and there's a narrative, as you mentioned before, in the finance industry. I'm doing my little part in our world to shake that, to question things, to break out of this need to just keep the status quo. You know, I mean, it's everywhere. And so there is something noble about that. But just the fact we're having a conversation, you're over on your side of the Atlantic, I'm over here, and we're talking about these things. To me, it's small victories. So tell us about the tour before I let you go.
Okay, so I'm coming to America. Sadly, I'm not hitting the West Coast, so I'm not going to be anywhere near you. This is a US East Coast mini tour, so it's by no means trying to cover the whole nation. Basically, I'm just hitting the Eastern Seaboard, and I'm doing 4 shows. So I'm bringing my mind control and music's military and mind control connections tour to 4 cities. I've picked 4 pretty tough ones to crack, I think, from what I'm told. But I'm hitting Boston, Philadelphia, New York City, and New Haven. Mm-hmm. So these events are about 3 hours long in 2 parts. So I speak for about 1.25 hours. We take a break, come back, speak for 1.25 hours. Then we do some audience Q&A at the end and book signing and such. And the first one happens on Wednesday, the 3rd of April. So it's not long now. It's about 2 weeks from today. And that's at the Union Tavern in Somerville, which is a district of Boston, from 7 to 10 p.m. The next one is Saturday, 6th of April. I'm going to be at the Misconduct Tavern in Philadelphia. That one takes place 6 to 9 p.m. The following day, Sunday, 7th of April, in New York City, at the Town School in Manhattan. And that is an afternoon gig, 2 to 5 p.m. Don't turn up in the evening or you miss it. And then the final one is New Haven, Connecticut. I love the idea of doing one of these talks in the home of Yale and Skull and Bones, which is where a lot of the skullduggery gets cooked up in America. Wow. So that one is at Bar New Haven, and it's happening 7 to 10 p.m. Wednesday, 10th of April. So tickets for all of these events are $35. I hope people will agree that that's a fairly reasonable ask for what they're going to be getting. It's going to be a whole load of information. And tickets are available on Ticket Tailor. I started selling them on Eventbrite, but I ran into a lot of problems with payment processing. I don't know if I was being messed with, but people were unable to buy tickets on that platform. So you can get them on Ticket Tailor. And there's details of all of them at djmarkdevlin.com/events. So I did a similar thing in Australia in November, which went really well. I did 4 gigs out there. And I've just done 3 in Scotland, just north of the border here. And they went really well as well. So I want to really try and get those numbers up on the US East Coast and get this information out to American audiences, man.
Well, I tell you what, you start on the East Coast and you make it there, you're good to go. As you head this direction, people tend to get a little more mellow as you head to the other end of the country.
I must do a West Coast tour as well at some point, I think.
Awesome. Hey, Mark, listen, I know you're busy. I really appreciate your time. It's great talking to you, and just God bless you and all the work you're doing, my man.
Emerson Fersh is a registered representative with and securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisor services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor and separate entity from Capital Investment Advisors. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. The guest speakers and the companies they represent are not affiliated with or endorsed by LPL Financial or Capital Investment Advisors. Individual tax and legal matters should be discussed with your tax or legal expert. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. There is no assurance that the techniques and strategies discussed are suitable for all investors or will yield positive outcomes. The purchase of certain securities may be required to affect some of the strategies. Investing involves risks, including possible loss of principal.